Welcome to the Sanity Interview. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and along with my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, we talk to the people you want to hear from.
And one of those is, of course, Dr. Pano Canellos, who joins us today. Thank you for being here. Dr. Canellos is the founding president of the University of Austin, a four-year nonprofit university that adheres to the increasingly rare principles of open inquiry, civil discourse, and the pursuit of truth. He's an outspoken advocate for liberal education with a prestigious and accomplished career in academia. Dr. Canellos is also a noted Shakespeare scholar, having served as the resident Shakespearean in the Old Globe MFA program and the founding director of the Interdisciplinary Shakespeare Studies Program at Loyola University, Chicago. Sadly, we're not going to be talking much about Shakespeare today, but maybe you'll come back
maybe
for that
discussion.
Maybe a little
bit, yeah. Dr.
Canellos, I wanted to start with a statement that UATX put out just this past week about admissions. And if you'll bear with me, I just want to read it because I fear that people may have missed it. And I think it's a really important statement. I just have to point out, I just have two 18-year-olds who just got into college last December. So I felt this in every word that was written. College admissions are unjust, not just biased, not just broken, unjust. Students spend high school anxiously stacking their resumes with hollow activities, then collect generic recommendation letters and outsource their essays to tutors or AI. Admissions at elite colleges now come down to who you know, your identity group, or how well you play the game. This system rewards manipulation, not merit. It selects for conformity, not character. That's why we're introducing the University of Austin's new admissions policy. If you score 1460 or more on the SAT, 33 or more on the ACT, or 105 plus on the CLT, you will be automatically admitted, pending basic eligibility and integrity check. Below that threshold, you'll be evaluated on your test scores, AP, IB results, and three verifiable achievements, each described in a single sentence. That was my favorite sentence in the whole thing. That's it. We care about two things, intelligence and courage. Intelligence to succeed in a rigorous intellectual environment. We don't inflate grades. Courage to join the first ranks of our truth-oriented university. College admission should be earned, not inherited, bought, or gamed. At the University of Austin, your merit earns you a place and full tuition scholarship. So not Shakespeare, but not far away in terms of great writing. And I just wondered if you would explain why the university felt the need now to put that out and what you hope the message is that's being sent.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on this, to have this conversation again. I'm very excited to be here. You did a great job with my name. Thank you so much. Here's how I would frame it. The purpose of universities is to find the most talented, meritorious young people and give them an opportunity to grow into an even better version of themselves. And what we should be looking for are young people who are creative in thinking, who are risk takers, who are willing to think outside the box when it comes to all different ideas. Those are the sorts of people who should be taking leadership roles in industry and society and all that. The current system for admission to most universities is predicated upon the opposite. You learn very quickly at a young age that there's a formula that you have to fill out. There are boxes that you have to check. You know, you have to do X, Y, and Z. You have to start the charity. You have to express this opinion in an essay. You have to, you know, do three varsity sports, no more, no less. And it just becomes an exercise in conformity, right? So, you know, students who are really eager, families who are really eager to see their kids admitted into high, you know, highly sought after universities are really playing a game. They're really checking boxes along the way. So what does this do? It teaches young people that the pathway to success is conformity. It's to look like everybody else. It's to follow the rules. And if you follow all the rules and check the boxes and you don't ruffle any feathers, there'll be, you know, a reward at the end of that process. And so then we bring young people into college and we've told them that the way forward is to conform. not to ask difficult questions, not to ruffle any feathers. We reinforce that at universities. You get to universities and like, look, you can only express a few opinions on political topics. And if you do anything else, you're going to get massacred on social media or your grades are going to suffer. So what we're seeing is we're taking the best and brightest young people in this country, and rather than accelerating the things that would make them succeed in society, the ability to think independently, to be creative, to take risks, we're suppressing all of that and creating a generation of conformists. So we wanted to create an admission system that wasn't in line with the box-checking game that most families face.
Oh, where were you a year ago?
But I mean, that system is reliant on standardized testing, right? I mean, to some extent. And maybe you could share with us, because a lot of people might say, hey, like, you know, the test prep industry and getting a specific number, you know, that's sort of part of this whole kind of, game or apparatus. So how do you think about merit, objectivity, and the role of these testing, which you've kind of put it as at least the first threshold towards admissions?
So first of all, the system doesn't rely on standardized testing. I think it's like 70 or 80% of universities are test optional now. So if you're test optional, what are you actually looking for? You're looking for all those intangible things, which, again, students have to compose a picture of themselves to match the expectations of the university. Standardized tests are objective. They measure something real. They measure intelligence. And there is a very, very strong correlation between how one does on a test like the SAT or ACT and their potential for academic success. Yes, some families can also treat that as part of the game and sort of bring, you know, pay a lot of money to tutors and you know, try to move their scores up. You know, data shows you can only move your scores up marginally. You're not going to go from 1,000 to a 1,400 on SAT. You might move it a few points, might move marginally. You know, people also pay a lot of money, you know, to tarot card readers to try and figure out the future. It doesn't mean that money actually achieves what it is that you're hoping to achieve. So some families can treat that like it's part of the game, but the objectivity of those tests actually resists that sort of treatment.
Mm-hmm. You know, I found in the application process, the most irksome thing for me as a mother was that the application seemed to select for activism, what I'm sort of putting in air quotes, activism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a form of conformity as well. In the way it shows up, but it's also led to a lot of problems that we see across campuses around the country. We're sort of teaching kids to speak before they think, to be activists on behalf of causes they perhaps don't know that much about. And so without squashing the sort of spirit of young people who want to run out and change the world, how do you message to your applicants that you want them to be activists but responsible ones?
So I also have a daughter who's 18 years old, my oldest, who's in college next year. So I've been in the thick of this just alongside you and have seen the essay questions that universities ask. And you're right. I mean, the message that they're sending in many of these questions is there's a right answer. And we really want you to give this right answer, you know, about, you know, what have you done for X, you know, social justice or that. And if you don't, it's going to harm your chances of getting in the university. It's implicit in there.
Yeah.
And students, I mean, it could be really soul crushing for a student to have to write something that they don't really believe in or fully understand. So, I think that is unconscionable, really. So how do we, let's say, create graduates who are capable of doing important things that matter in the world? We have a very, I think, elegant solution to that. Every single student who comes to the University of Austin, undergraduate, has to work on a 4-year-long Polaris project. The Polaris project is, you know, Polaris is the North Star. This is a project that they're going to start from the moment they get here and that they're going to work towards over the course of their undergraduate years. And the focus of this is, first of all, to try and align a student's particular skills and gifts with a very important need in the world. something that's for the common good. So the first part of this is about who are you? Like, what are your values? What are your skills? What do you have to contribute? And then how do we find a way to line that up with something you can actually do that will matter? So we begin with the student, and then we actually do it. Like, you know, all these, like, you know, social activist expectations that you have at other universities, other than, you know, the prospect of, you know, going out and attending a protest or something, they don't actually teach you how to do anything. We're like, okay, what do you want to achieve? Now we're going to help you design a project, build a project, connect with mentors, do everything. And the projects are amazing because what they do is they line up with the student's academic
interest. Can you give an example?
Absolutely. So I've used this frequently. One young woman who is part of our inaugural class, when I met with her, I said, you know, well, tell me about, like, what are, like, the thing that you care about most? Like, what's your real passion? And she said, well, I love the ancient world. I love classical Greece and Rome. I love classical languages. And I'm like, that's great. And in my mind, I'm like, ooh, this is going to be like, how do you do like a project to benefit the common good? You know, I said, so, okay, what can we do with this? How can you take that passion and aim for something that will bring it to the world in an important way? And she thought for a moment and she said, you know, recently I was reading an article that said there are fewer than 100,000 people in the world who can still read ancient Greek. She said, my project over the next 4 years is to teach 100,000 more people how to read ancient Greek. And I thought, what an amazing thing, right? And think about
just for our listeners, as someone who took a year or two of it, ancient Greek is really hard. I mean,
that's part of the reason that not many people speak it. But think about you set your task. And so it's not just about teaching, right? It's like, how do you reach those people? How do you convince them this is a value? So it's marketing. There's an economic model you have to create. What is the delivery mechanism? How do you, like, who you need to talk to that's going to help you solve this problem? So you take a problem, you identify it, something that's important, and then you figure out how to solve it. And you do that. It's about a third of your time at the university is spent on this project.
I love that. I mean, imagine 100+ years ago, you know, someone saying that in the future, you know, 6 million people will speak Hebrew as their first language, right? I mean, that's that kind of ambition. Yeah. So cool. I just had a memory. It's not exactly a question, Pano, but I remember I was at Harvard, and about 10 years ago, William Dereswitz came out with his Excellent Sheep book. And I remember there was a big kind of book talk about it at the biggest theater at Harvard. It's, you know, Sanders Theater. And the atmosphere was electric, and it was filled with students who were sort of there to pack the halls for someone to tell them that they were sheep. And it was a sort of strange night, but there was a hunger, I think, or a recognition that somehow this diagnosis was kind of right, and that and the professors who were there came in for a lot of criticism too. So I guess my question is, sort of in designing, you know, this bespoke program at the University of Austin, I mean, are your ambitions are, I'm sure, larger and have to do with this whole generation of people who, you know, who I think are looking, you know? I guess that's my question. Do you think that people, that your regular college student recognizes that something is off and is interested, or is that not the model? Is it more kind of building a separate kind of monastery, you know, down in Austin and hoping people come to you?
So we don't want to build a monastery. I mean, we're building an institution that is meant to be, to have broader impact. So this is this is our Polaris project. Like, how are we bringing our passion to the greater good? In fact, the Polaris is the symbol on our shield. It's the symbol of the university, the Polaris Star. So the students that we've attracted so far, all have expressed to us that they're here because they feel like what's being offered at mainstream universities is not meeting their deepest needs, that they feel out of sync. And they want to be at an institution that is doing things differently, that's modeling a different kind of education. And they're willing to take an extraordinary risk to do that. Imagine being you know, we only have freshmen now because this is our first year of operating. We're going to add a class each year. Imagine being an 18-year-old going to a brand new university, untested, untried. You couldn't even visit a class before you came here because we didn't have them. You couldn't talk to a student because we didn't have any yet. And you're coming to this university and you know that your responsibility isn't just to go to this university, but it's to help build the university. You know, and you gather nearly 100 young people like this in a freshman class, and you create this first year, we've been creating the university with them. That's one of the things that I think is massively distinctive about our project. This isn't like a whole bunch of like middle-aged bald guys like me drawing on the back of a napkin what a university should be. It's a group of us coming together and creating a project and then literally integrating into that project the students and the faculty who want more out of higher education, and then figuring out how to build this institution together. And as you build it, you model things that other institutions start to pay attention to. For example, one of the things that we hold sacred in our classes to ensure that everybody can speak their mind and open up about ideas is that we abide by the Chatham House rule. The Chatham House rule says that whatever is said in the context of the seminar or meeting, whatever, cannot be repeated with attribution in the outside world. Because if you do that, you're putting the person who said something potentially at risk. The thing that suppresses conversation in almost every college classroom in the country is the fear that students and faculty have that if they advance an idea that seemed to be unpopular or heterodox or outside the box, that they're going to pay social or professional penalty for doing that. If you're afraid of speaking, you don't speak. So by implementing the Chatham House rule, we're saying it's like, look, this is a sacred space. You can express your ideas as long as you back them up by evidence. You could throw ideas out there maybe you don't even believe in, but you want to challenge things. And you don't have to worry about the consequences for that. The worst consequences you're going to face is to learn that your ideas are kind of dumb because somebody's going to disprove them in class. That's the worst consequence. So what we found is just by implementing this simple rule, our classes are more intellectually alive than any institution I've been a part of. And I've worked across higher education. So the reason I bring this up now is very recently, Harvard has decided to adopt the Chatham House rule. And I don't know if it's a university-wide or just their arts and sciences college. Well, that's following on the heels of us introducing this in higher education. So you can be a very small institution, and the ripple effects of what you're doing, if what you're doing is something that matters, can be quite wide.
I wonder, you're drawing obviously from a pool of kids who have grown up in the K through 12 system in America, private public schools. Are there models of K through 12 education that are sort of feeding into your pool of applicants better than others? And are there changes in the K through 12 system? I know that's not your area, but you know, you might have some impact on changing that system to draw in the best candidates to schools like yours.
Yeah. So yes, what we see is a significant streams of students coming from classical schools, homeschool kids, experimental schools of one sort or another. So a lot of our families are families who've already kind of made the decision to sort of be outside the mainstream of K through 12 education.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, just to jump on Rebecca's question about homeschooling, which you know, we've covered here at the paper from kind of legal constitutional elements as well as just educational ones, and the other is religious schooling, which obviously is a very live issue now. Those two groups.
Those groups are very well represented on our campus. And again, I mean, I think people who have made, you know, choices in the K through 12 space that are not entirely conventional, or probably a little more open to a not entirely conventional university experience. But I have to say that the thing that actually inspired me early on in this project to start a new university was I was playing around with a notion of trying to create charter universities. So I think the charter school movement, I'm a big fan of the charter school movement. I think it introduces market competition in the system and experimentation in a way that really benefits K through 12 education. So, you know, I'm a fanboy. I'm like, what if we had that in college? Like, what if we had a system that allowed relatively easy entry for new universities to come in that could try different ways of doing things that would receive at least marginal funding so that the barrier to entry wasn't so extreme. So I'd been playing around with that idea and then realized it's not going to happen, at least not for a very long time. And we need change now. So let's just build a new university and then use that university as a model for others to build other universities, like show how it's done, show that it can be done. So I took inspiration from the charter movement in K-12. We are also here at the University of Austin building our own Center for Education and Public Service with the express purpose of creating new and better ways to teach teachers how to teach, creating programs in educational entrepreneurship. In other words, teach people how to open new schools and create new curricula, and to work on issues around educational policy. So that should be opening in about a year or two.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask about the Department of Education and what this administration is planning to do there? And you don't necessarily have to get political, but maybe if you sort of broaden out, what's your view on the appropriate role of the federal government in education across the country? And, you know, how does federal funding, I know that you're a not-for-profit university and you rely on private funds, but do you have federal funding as well? And what do you think the role of that should be with universities around the country?
Obviously a hot question now.
Yeah, that's the one.
So we don't take any federal funding. And we've designed a financial model that won't rely on federal funding. To be fair, we're not yet eligible for federal funding anyway. So even if I decided to take it, we couldn't take it. You have to advance further in the accreditation process to be eligible. But we built a financial model that doesn't depend upon it. I have no crystal ball when it comes to what this administration is going to do on higher ed, other than I think we're all fairly confident that they're going to shake things up, and starting at the top, probably radically reduce or potentially dissolve the Department of Ed. The area that I think is of the greatest interest to me and to us here is the area of accreditation, because right now, accreditation is the gateway to federal funds, to research grants that come through the federal government. And the way the accreditation system is structured is that there are sort of six major accreditors across the country that you can work with. And they all differ slightly from one another, but largely they're following federal guidelines because the federal government is using them as a conduit to federal funding for individual institutions. The accreditation process, as it's currently construed, it makes it almost impossible to start a new university because you can't be fully accredited, at least now, until you graduate your first class of students. So think about that. You have to open a university, attract students, you're not yet accredited, you're not guaranteed you're going to be accredited, and you can't be accredited if you attract and graduate students. It's like a cart before the horse problem. And during that time, you're not eligible for federal funding if you wanted it. You can't do things like use the Common App. You can't even use .edu. And so you go to the world and you present this model, this, let's say, experimental or different model for higher education, and you're hobbled by the system, but you have to participate in the system. So in Texas, for example, we are authorized by the state of Texas to be a university. So we're a degree-granting, four-year, nonprofit, private university. So we can grant degrees, but those degrees won't be accredited until probably year five. So that very first class you have to attract knows that they're going to graduate with an unaccredited college degree. Yet you can't be accredited unless you attract that class of students.
I wonder, though, has that liberated you at all, though, to be a little bit outside the system for this period of time, to not be on the Common App, to not, you know, in terms of your ability to design from scratch? I mean, would you have taken federal funding right away if you could?
I don't think so. Federal funding is not the big issue here for me. The main issue here is that not being accredited is a stigmatizing thing for students and families. So it makes it hard to attract students. They have to be pretty confident that you're going to get accreditation. And how do you know that so early in the process? So the main issue for me is not about access to funding at all. It's about the way that the accreditation system delegitimizes schools that aren't yet accredited. The truth is, every single university out there is currently undergoing the exact same process we're going through. Every school is on basically a 7-year accreditation cycle, and you have to be reaccredited. We're just in our first cycle. So we're going through the same thing Harvard's going through right now. We're working on our accreditation. Right. But until you complete that first cycle, you have a kind of provisional accreditation that's not finalized. And it's more about that perception. So, you know, we've been able to attract amazing students in spite of the system. And it's because the vision of the university, the people who are involved with the university have been compelling enough to bring in, you know, an extraordinary class of students, extraordinary faculty. But for most, like, you know, new institutions, it's almost impossible to get through those barriers. And they don't even try. Like, they come up with ideas and like, they're not going to do it. I mean, there's a reason that we are the first new private university in the state of Texas since 1963. The population of Texas has gone from 10 million to 30 million people in that time, yet we're the first new university. Yeah. It just shows you how many barriers to entry there are.
Can I ask another sort of news relevant question? It's a hot topic now, is the issue of foreign students. I know that you don't have that many of them at the moment, but could you give us your thoughts on, again, not maybe a specific school or a specific issue, but unless you want to, but, you know, zoom out and sort of, what's the role for foreign students in the American university system? What's the right number? I think we have 1.1 million at the moment, something like that. Is that too high? Is that too low? Can you give us the pros and the cons and explain to people your view on foreign students?
So yet another challenge with accreditation, we actually can't take any foreign students because we can't offer F1 visas until we go a certain distance through the accreditation process. We have 3 international students, but they all have dual citizenship. So they came to us from Germany, Argentina, and Turkey, but they had a kind of dual status so they could come. So yeah, that's another thing. Like, we're not eligible for that pool of students. What do I think about foreign students? I think there's some misconceptions. So people think that foreign students are like cash in the bank for universities, right? That the reason you admit a high number of foreign students is because they're going to pay full tuition and most of your domestic students are not paying full tuition. And this subsidizes the operation. The truth is that's only true at the most elite universities, right? So the full pay, like rich kids from country X and that, are not going to the regional state university or, you know, the second tier liberal arts college. They're not going there. So that's a bit of misperception that the students who are coming in are just flooding the system with money.
Well, just to stop you, to the degree that that is true at some of these elite universities, do you view that as a problem that needs to be solved for?
I think differently about public and private institutions. So I think private institutions can do whatever they want. And you could
and
open an institution 100% foreign students. That's market freedom. I have no problem with that. Whether it's good for the institution, I don't know, but that's, they can do what they want. I think public institutions do have a particular obligation towards first the citizens of their states and then citizens more broadly because of the public money that they receive. So I'd feel differently about those things. I will say that the great majority of international students at most institutions are brought here because there aren't enough domestic students to fill all the seats across higher education. We have a demographic problem, right? There are fewer and fewer college-bound students trying to fill the 4,000 institutions that we have. And this year in particular, 2025, we're reaching what's called a demographic cliff. So we've known for a long time, you know, math is our friend, right? And so you know that 18-year-olds are most of the students who start at 4-year universities. And you could, if you subtract 18 from any given year, you get back to another year. So we know that if you subtract 18 from 2025, you're back in 2007 and 2008 in the financial crisis. There was a serious demographic drop off then, which we haven't recovered from. So everybody in higher ed has been expecting this demographic cliff in 2025. We're here now. And you know, the estimates of the number of students that are not entering the system, so had been something about 15 to 20% fewer students entering the system. COVID kind of accelerated this for complicated reasons. We couldn't foresee COVID, but it kind of accelerated. So most schools out there have campuses and faculty and administrations and not enough students. That's the role that international students are playing. A lot of universities is filling those seats. So the question becomes, should those universities bring in those students so that they can continue to operate? It depends on how many universities you think we need. Because if they don't bring in those students, we're going to see a lot more universities fail.
We have to let you go soon, but let me ask you a final question, and not necessarily an easy one. You know, obviously, these elite universities are now being buffeted by crisscrossing and multiplying crises around relationship with the federal government, behavior issues, freedom of speech. We all know the scene. I mean, what advice would you give to one of your peer presidents at one of these universities? Where to start? Is it with the admissions process? Is it with a kind of recommitment to a sort of basic set of values? Is it sort of just emergency, a couple of easy measures that can be taken that could kind of turn down the temperature? I mean, how do you, as you build your school, what are you seeing as you look at these schools in crisis?
So one of the things that's been heartening to me is you see more and more schools, including major universities like Vanderbilt, who are coming out and saying the purpose of universities is the, you know, discovery of knowledge and the preservation of knowledge and transmission of knowledge. To do that, you have to have intellectually pluralistic campuses. You have to promote free speech, civil discourse. Essentially, the principles that our institution is built on are becoming adopted more and more. And it's just schools are responding. They understand that the market wants that. And here's a way to think about it. Universities have become very, very expensive. And taking 4 years out of your life is a huge commitment. If an institution tells you, we want you to come here and spend $70,000 a year so that you can... you know, you can help us promote social justice. Like you become part of the social justice warrior army. And, you know, you're going to pay us for that privilege. At some point, families are going to be like, that's not how I want to invest, you know,
our graduate unemployable. And yeah.
So if universities say, look, it's not inexpensive to run universities. It just isn't. Whether the price of universities is too high, I think it is, but let's, you know, but you're going to make a significant investment in your child's future. And what we're going to do is we're going to take the most important thing they have, their mind, and we're going to teach them how to exercise that in a way that will prepare them for the knowledge economy, prepare them for human flourishing, prepare them to lead. That's an investment you want to make. And so to show that you're an institution committed to making that investment, you have to show that you're committed to the pursuit of truth, to civil discourse, to intellectual freedom, and to the things that allow for the full development of our intellectual capacities. So that's the bottom line. What's heartening is more and more schools have gotten that message.
You know, we didn't even get to the whole future of education and AI and all those things. And so maybe you'll come back and do a, you know, an episode 2 for us about what you see going into the future. But for now, we thank you very much for this review.
Such a pleasure.
What's happening now.
Thank you, President Canales. Thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you.